Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1982, today's guest, Judge LaDora Hazard Cordell, became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California. She held that position until 2001, so she knows firsthand how prejudice has permeated the U.S. legal system. Following her retirement from the bench, Judge Cordell was a vice provost at Stanford University, and in 2010, she was appointed independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. In her new memoir, Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It, Judge Cordell provides a rare insider account of the legal system. And we thought she would be the perfect guest to talk about the future of abortion in the United States, the Kyle Rittenhouse acquittal, and the guilty verdict of the Ahmaud Arbery case. Judge Cordell, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much, Rose. I'm glad to be here.
Well, it's great to have you. Judge Cordell, these cases, I mean, so much has happened in the last couple of months. These cases really show us the power of judges, and they show us why it's so important to learn about and understand how the system works.
Absolutely. And that is the primary reason why I wrote Her Honor, insider look from the perspective of a trial court judge, a state trial court judge, about our legal system. And I do want to note it just at the outset that there are good things about our legal system. And by that, I mean that the legal system in America is based upon some wonderful principles, the principles of due process, the right of against self-incrimination, the right to a jury trial. Excuse me. But at the same time, these principles were developed by white males, propertied males who owned people who look like me. Mm-hmm. And as a result of that, we have a legal system where the problem is in the implementation of these principles. They are not applied equally and fairly to people of color, to women, and to poor people. So our job is to make this system comply with those principles so that they are equally applied to all.
In your book, you have a chapter called The Fix, where you discuss how broken the system is. And it's so interesting because you don't call the system the criminal justice system. You call it the criminal legal system. Can you talk more about that?
Sure. Because when we have justice, then if we had justice, there would have been no reason for me to write this book. We're not there yet. We're on the way, I hope, to bringing justice to our legal system. But until such time, and I spoke specifically about the criminal legal system, we're not there. And if you look at the disproportionate number of people of color and poor people who are incarcerated, resulting in mass incarceration in this country, that's just one indicator. Another indicator is the use of peremptory challenges in criminal trials that are used to exclude people of color. And that was really in evidence in the Ahmaud Arbery case. Actually, was in both the Rittenhouse case, but especially in the Ahmaud Arbery case, because the trial judge there in Georgia specifically said that the use of peremptory challenges by those who were representing the three white men who were convicted, thankfully convicted of killing Ahmaud Arbery, had used peremptory challenges as, he said, it was intentional racism, and at the same time kind of threw up his hands because the law in Georgia is such that if a lawyer who is asked, why did you exclude all these people of color using your peremptory challenges, which are challenges where you don't have to give a reason, if the answer is race neutral, then there isn't anything the judge can do. And so when they give race neutral answers like, well, that person looked angry to me and looked like they didn't want to be here, that was good enough. Fortunately, the jurors still arrived at a proper and just decision in this case, albeit with just one African-American on the jury.
What information can you share with people about how the jury is selected? Because as you point out, in the Ahmaud Arbery case, defense attorneys removed 8 of the 9 black jurors.
This removal of people of color from juries, especially in criminal cases, is not unusual. Juries, I have a chapter in my book called Thank You for Your Service, and it is about juries, from how they're selected to how they deliberate, and the influence that judges have on jurors. And I don't mean just verbal. I mean also nonverbal conduct that can influence how juries look at defendants, look at witnesses that testify. So jury selection we need to take a hard look at it. One big problem is that at least when I presided over juries, and it was nearly 20 years in Santa Clara County, I very rarely saw African-American or Latino jurors. One main reason is that jurors who are, say, of lower income can't afford to take the time, days, weeks, sometimes months, to sit on a jury. So I ended up seeing juries that were mostly white, older people, mostly retired, who had the time and were available to sit as jurors. So we need to address that. We need to have more diversity in our juries. This is like we need more diversity in everything. And by diversity, I don't mean a token. I mean representational diversity. Mm-hmm. So one of the suggestions I make in my chapter called The Fix is that we need to really recognize that juries matter. And one way to do that is to increase the compensation that's paid to jurors. Most people don't know that jurors do get paid in most states. Some states do not. The state of Delaware doesn't compensate its jurors. In California, compensation is $15 a day, and it doesn't include the first day. And I think that's outrageous, and we need to address that.
What would it take to increase compensation?
Well, two things, and I mentioned them in the book. One is that look at major businesses and companies, Microsoft, Facebook, Google, who regularly use our courts all of the time. But they are not required, when their employees are called for jury duty, they're not required to continue to pay their employees' salaries while they're serving as jurors. That should change. They can well afford to do that, and those jurors should be compensated. For smaller companies that have just a handful of employees that can't afford to pay those salaries while those employees are sitting on juries, then I recommend that there be a state juror compensation fund. So those individuals working for these smaller companies can be fully compensated their salaries when they're serving as jurors. And that fund also should be used to compensate individuals also who are even unemployed, who could also serve on the juries.
Why don't you grab a glass of water? Today we are speaking with Judge LaDoris Hazard Cordell. She's out with a new memoir, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. Judge Cordell became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California in 1982. She held that position until 2001. She has really served the public for many, many years, so we thought she would be the perfect guest to talk about the legal system in this country. We're going to talk about the Ahmaud Arbery case, the guilty verdict in that one, the Kyle Rittenhouse acquittal, and then yesterday's Supreme Court the Supreme Court hearing arguments and the Mississippi abortion ban. Judge Cordell, it's so interesting to think about. You were so young when you were appointed to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California in 1982. So much has changed since then. And I just wonder what your thoughts are on how the public follows and perceives cases in the age of social media. Because even I thought I was following the Ahmaud Arbery case, but I didn't realize how much I missed until I watched this incredible documentary on 2020 by Deborah Roberts, who really brought context to the case. I mean, to think that Ahmaud Arbery's mom, Wanda Cooper Jones, spent almost 2 years fighting for justice. So what are your thoughts? Not only are we exposed to more cases because of social media, but now we just get bits of information. And I don't think we spend enough time really bringing in the context.
Well, the age of social media is a blessing and it's a curse. It's a blessing in that so many more people are now aware of what's happening in our courts. And I think that's so important. When I started, as you noted, I was just 32 years old when I started on the bench and spent nearly 20 years on the bench. We didn't have, at least initially, the social media. So what people learned was what they read in the newspapers and saw on TV. Now we have social media, which means that many, many more people are aware of what's going on in our courts. And I think that's a good thing. We need to hold all of the players, the judges, the lawyers, litigants, we need to hold them accountable. And the best way to do that is with transparency and letting people know what's going on. But on the other side, it's a curse, because with social media, what you get are these sound bites, these quick little phrases and descriptors that do not capture the essence of what's happening actually in the trial or what's happening in a particular hearing. And the problem with that is that people then go with this, don't tend to question the accuracy, and then start reacting in ways that are not helpful and are not productive. So it's harder. And if I had it to do now, today, to start off as a judge, I would be more hesitant to want to be on the bench just because of the impact of social media.
And so many judges are being attacked on social media, and they're being attacked in their personal lives because of social media.
Right. And that I find troubling. The attacks. So first of all, judges should be held accountable. And when judges misbehave, when judges are engaged in malfeasance or committing crimes, absolutely they should be held accountable, and people have every right to be upset and demand that those judges no longer serve on the bench. But there's a difference between that kind of misconduct and judges who make decisions that are controversial, meaning they're lawful. They are absolutely lawful, but it isn't what people like. And that's where social media has been utilized to come after judges, because people, members of the public, just don't like what the judge did. And the problem with that is that we lose our independent judiciary. And by that, an independent judiciary doesn't look, the judge doesn't look over their shoulders to see, whoa, if I make this decision, am I going to be liked or not? Do I have to worry about being recalled or losing my job? That's not an independent judiciary. That's a judiciary that is responding to the mob. And that is really going to destroy our democracy. There are three legs to our democracy: the legislative, executive, and the judiciary. And when one of those legs gets pulled out, we lose our democracy. And I'm very concerned about losing our independent judiciary.
I think it also really affects the public when you see how judges handle themselves. In the case of Ahmaud Arbery and Kyle Rittenhouse, I mean, these judges were on opposite ends of the spectrum. You have a chapter in your book called Bad Judges, and you say that you would have put Judge Bruce Schroeder in that chapter, and Judge Schroeder presided over the Kyle Rittenhouse trial.
Absolutely. The two judges, I agree with you, were completely different in how they handled the trial. So let me just talk for a moment about the Judge Schroeder, who presided over the Kyle Rittenhouse case. And this was in Wisconsin. This judge was appointed to the bench in Wisconsin a year after I was. And so he was appointed in 1983. He is still on the bench and has been serving for 38 years. He's 75 years old. And there's no time limit on how long judges can serve. So he can serve until he decides he doesn't want to serve or is challenged in an election. So what he did in the Kyle Rittenhouse case violated just every rule that exists that guides the conduct of judges. So every state, as I note in my book, has a code of conduct for judges. In Wisconsin, there is a specific canon or principle or rule that says that judges shall perform the duties of judicial office impartially and diligently. And specifically, it says they are to perform their duties without bias or prejudice, and they may not do anything that shows that kind of bias or prejudice. This judge violated that rule over and over. And I'll just give you a few quick examples. when the expert, an expert witness for the defense, was on the stand. This is for the defense in favor of Kyle Rittenhouse. The judge asked if there were any veterans in the courtroom. And then when that witness at the witness stand raised his hand, his name was John Black, the judge directed everyone in the courtroom to thank that person and to applaud. So there was all this applause, and think of the impact this has on people in the courtroom about how the judge feels about an expert witness for the defense. The judge consistently yelled at the prosecutors, did not raise his voice when he addressed the defense attorneys. He actually conducted his own cross-examination and interjected himself into the cross-examination in the case. He made his own objections for the defense, and he actually gave advice to the defense about how to argue to the jury about self-defense. And there's one other thing. There's a photo op that is just says it all, where you have the judge leaning over, looking at something, maybe it was a piece of evidence, and Kyle Rittenhouse at the witness stand leaning over and almost touching the judge. They're almost shoulder to shoulder. Mm-hmm. And when a jury sees that and sees that the judge is very comfortable having this witness, this defendant, right close to him, that sends a message directly to them that the judge really likes this person. And all of that is just, it's just terrible. And as a result of all of that, and of course, the arguments that were made in that case, Kyle Rittenhouse was acquitted. Then you have the judge, Timothy Walmsley, in the Ahmaud Arbery case, who conducted himself quite differently. He was appointed in 2012 to the bench. And you didn't find any of those kinds of things, what I call misconduct, that Judge Schroeder did in the other case. And I think he presided over the case fairly, even though he was really helpless to do anything about the exclusion of all of those African-Americans from the jury.
Can anything be done when a judge engages in the misconduct that you describe?
Absolutely. Anyone, you don't have to be a Wisconsin, for example, anyone can file a complaint about a judge. And in my book, in the appendix to the book, I have a list of state by state of a link to every single disciplinary body for every state for judges. So you can go to Wisconsin, click the link, and you can read about the discipline of judges. And there's information about how one files a complaint. So anyone can do that. And once a complaint is filed, the disciplinary body in that state must conduct an investigation. So, and if the judge is found to have engaged in misconduct, the judge can be removed from the bench. The judge can be disciplined by being suspended or publicly censored or privately admonished.
In order to that, for that to happen, you have to have a system in place that actually works, right?
And I wrote about that, that yeah. Most people have no idea that judges can be disciplined by these bodies and how they are, because there's very little transparency. I had a hard time when I was trying to find the links to all of these disciplinary bodies throughout the country, because some of them are just not really evident. I really had to dig to find them. So what I write in the fix is that we need to have transparency. The disciplinary hearings should be public proceedings. They should be live streamed, available to the public, and everyone should know and can know, by the way, if they go to these links, if judges have been disciplined and for what specifically and what the discipline was.
Talking more about the Kyle Rittenhouse case, again, he shot and killed two people and seriously injured one. And the judge told prosecutors that they could not refer to the people Rittenhouse shot as victims. He said they could call them arsonists, looters, or rioters. He said, quote, "The word victim is a loaded, loaded word, and I think alleged victim is a cousin to it," end quote. How significant was that? What did you make of that?
Absolutely outrageous, and another example of misconduct. So the words arsonist, looter, and rioter are not loaded. Of course they're loaded. And what he was doing was putting a label and sending a message to the jurors about the victims in this case. And I'm sure the families of these victims were just appalled. So it's just yet another instance of this judge showing this bias. And it's routine in most cases, and in fact, all cases, and I presided over lots of cases where there were victims to call them alleged victims, because the accused is an alleged accused. It's not until the jury brings in a verdict do you then call them officially victims, and officially this person is then convicted. So what this judge did was, again, appalling, but it's actually consistent with his behavior in this case. We don't forget about the ringtone he had when his phone, cell phone, and I'm not sure it was an accident, went off in a courtroom, and it played the theme song that was used in the Trump rallies around the country.
Yeah, that was incredible. I mean, please go ahead. What do you do at that point? How do you respond to something like that?
Well, so here's what didn't happen in the courtroom. The prosecutors didn't speak up. The prosecutors, and again, I would have done this if I were a prosecutor in that case. It's just as if they were intimidated by the judge. What they needed to do was make a record and each time state that, judge, you know, this, I believe you are biased when you did X, Y, and Z. The judge might get upset. No, I didn't. You know, that's not biased. And the prosecutor would say, I'm making a record. I am making a record. And that was not done in this case. But even if the prosecutor had done that, because the jury acquitted, there's nothing that can be done. Once you are acquitted, that's it. The person is free to do whatever that person wants to do. So even if they had made the record, it would have been good in terms of disciplining the judge. But in terms of impacting the jury, it would not, I think, have sufficed at all. And it might have even alienated the jurors even more. I do want to bring up, though, there is another case in Wisconsin, in Kenosha, involving a Black woman. Actually, she was a teenager, 17 years old, Crystal Kaiser, who was... she is charged with first degree murder and killing a man who she claims was trafficking her. And the big difference here, now, Kyle Rittenhouse killed three people, injured a fourth. And you have Crystal Kaiser, who killed her alleged abuser. She sat in jail with $1 million bail for 2 years. And only recently has she been released because the judge, in terms of public pressure, reduced her bail to $400,000. And she was recently released because there was fundraising going on. So you look at this. You have Kyle Rittenhouse, a young white kid who was free, killed three people, injured for and carrying a gun. This is a young woman claimed she was trafficked and claimed and killed her trafficker, alleged trafficker, and sat in jail for 2 years. And she still doesn't even have a trial date set. So just the glaring disparities in how the system is not applying its principles fairly to all people really stands out. And I think in these two cases,
this reminds me of the Cyntoia Brown case, who also killed her abuser and was finally released after a massive public outcry.
I'm not familiar with that case, but it sounds the same. And so here we are. The issues become not just race, but also gender issues. So women who are accused of killing another person treated differently than we have. And again, I'm just back to the Kyle Rittenhouse, and there are other examples. And you have this teenager with an AR-15 who is able to go home, hang out, and come back and be out of custody the whole time. So again, it's a bit frustrating, but at the same time, I have faith. I believe in our legal system. As long as we have people who care enough to say we need to change it, we need to make it more fair.
And in the other case that you mentioned when we were talking about Crystal Kaiser, according to the Lily, her case could decide and shape how future crimes involving victims of trafficking are litigated, particularly those in which child victims of trafficking have killed their alleged abusers. In past decades, those teenagers were painted by prosecutors as, quote, child prostitutes who were out to rob their clients.
Exactly. So in Wisconsin, there is a law now that makes an affirmative defense is that if you are the victim of trafficking and you kill your abuser, that is what's called an affirmative defense, meaning that it enables you to not be convicted of the killing. So that is a law in effect in Wisconsin, and that is a recognition that these children who are so abused and who then respond by killing their abusers are no longer looked at as prostitutes and using just pejoratives and seeing them in a negative fashion. That being said, even with that law in the books, the Crystal Kizer case is going to be a test of that because she will be using that as an affirmative defense. But I am still so concerned about, even with that law in the books, how long it has taken for her just to walk out of the jail. She has not been convicted of any crime, but sat in jail for 2 years with this, even with this affirmative defense being available.
Before we go to break, Judge Cordell, how much influence do protests and public outcry have on cases like this?
The public outcry is absolutely critical to making our legal system better. And I'm going to switch and the best example I can think of right now is the Britney Spears case. Hmm. So we're talking about a conservatorship, but we're talking about a trial court judge who, and more than one trial court judge who presided over her case, and for 13 years felt that, oh, this conservatorship was just fine. But when people began to say, wait a minute, there's no transparency here, and what's the reason? And started demanding that the conservatorship be ended, look what happened. Transparency, the hearing became open. People could know what was going on. And all of a sudden, a judge decides, well, we don't need the conservatorship anymore. What changed? Nothing changed but accountability and the cry from the public saying, we demand accountability and transparency. And once that happened, things began to change. Mm-hmm. So that's a prime example of how public awareness and is so important in holding our legal system accountable.
Today, we are speaking with Judge LaDoris Hazard Cordell. Judge Cordell became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California in 1982. She held that position until 2001, and she's out with a new memoir called Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are speaking with Judge LaDoris Hazard Cordell. Judge Cordell became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California. She served from 1982 to 2001. Following her retirement from the bench, Judge Cordell was a vice provost at Stanford University, and in 2010, she was appointed independent police auditor for the city of San Jose. Judge Cordell is out with a new memoir, Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. If you have any questions for Judge Cordell about what it is like to be a judge, the legal system, and then the cases that we're talking about today, the Kyle Rittenhouse acquittal, the guilty verdict in the Ahmaud Arbery case, and hopefully we'll have time to talk about the future of abortion in the United States, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email Your Call at kalw.org. Just to remind listeners that Kyle Rittenhouse's case began after police in Kenosha, Wisconsin, shot and injured a black man named Jacob Blake. He survived, but he is paralyzed from the waist down. And I'm just reading from NPR now. The Blake shooting, which took place less than 3 months after the death of George Floyd, ignited protests around Kenosha. Over several nights, protesters destroyed police cars and burned down a used car dealership, a furniture store, and a state parole office. On October 25th, the third night of protests, Kyle Rittenhouse, then 17, made the short trip from his home in Illinois across the state line, armed with an AR-15-style rifle, in response to a call from a Kenosha-based militia group saying it hoped to protect businesses from protesters. That night, Rittenhouse shot several people, killing two, Joseph Rosenbaum and Anthony Huber, and wounded a third, Gage Grosskreutz. Judge Cordell, can you remind us what charges did Kyle Rittenhouse face?
So Kyle Rittenhouse faced the charges of murder of the three people that were killed. And he also faced a charge for the attempted murder of the person he injured. But what was unique in Wisconsin was their law about self-defense. In most states, the burden is on the person claiming self-defense to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that self-defense was justified. Because once self-defense is justified, there is no crime. That means the killing of another person was justified and therefore was not a criminal act. In Wisconsin, the burden of proving self-defense is not on the defendant. It wasn't on Kyle Rittenhouse. It was on the prosecutor to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that self-defense was not justified. So Kyle Rittenhouse asserted self-defense, but it was on the prosecutor to disprove it beyond a reasonable doubt. And that law exists because laws in Wisconsin and other states are becoming more and more favorable to guns and the possession of guns. The gun culture has influenced the legislature in Wisconsin such that they've decided to shift the burden over. So it isn't the person who used the gun to kill someone. It isn't their burden to prove that what they did was justified. It was the burden of the prosecutor to prove that what they did was not justified as self-defense. And as a result of that, the jury followed the law in Wisconsin and found that they just didn't buy the argument that the prosecution was making, that self-defense had not been disproven.
So what do you make of the case and the verdict? Because I've heard some lawyers say that there wasn't a case from the beginning and they were not surprised with the verdict. And other lawyers said that if there had been a stronger prosecutor, perhaps the ending would have been different.
I see both sides of this. Because the law is as it is in Wisconsin, it was a difficult case for the prosecutors to even bring. Should they not have charged? No, I disagree with that. I think that charges should have been brought. Absolutely. But at the same time, this was indeed an uphill battle, given how the laws were written in Wisconsin. With regard to how well the prosecutors presented the case, I was concerned about their lack of willingness to really confront the judge on the judge's interruptions and the judge's a clear bias in the case without labeling it at all. But one wonders, I mean, they have to appear in front of this judge, I guess, later on. And I guess they're somewhat intimidated and concerned about that, which means, you know, there should have been consideration given, as was done in the George Floyd, the murder case there, to getting in outside prosecutors to come in who are not going to appear in front of that judge regularly. Someone perhaps maybe from the state attorney general's office to prosecute the case. In the Ahmaud Arbery case, the prosecutor there who initially looked at the case and decided not to prosecute is facing criminal charges. And what they did, they went to another county and brought in a prosecutor to handle the case there. And of course, the law was different as well in Georgia. But I do want to note, you know, in the Arbery case, it took 74 days before those three men were even charged with the crime. And that was only because one of them eventually it released a video because he was so proud of what they did in killing Ahmaud Arbery. And it was that video that went viral that finally resulted in their convictions.
And we'll talk about that in just a couple of minutes. I have one more question for you on Rittenhouse.
Sure.
What precedent does this set in states with open carry laws? This is what people are so concerned about.
And people should be concerned. I am concerned. We all should be concerned that someone can carry these weapons. I'm talking an AR-15 here, and walk away and be deemed a hero for killing three people. So these laws, I'm very concerned about vigilantism, about the message it's sending to people to just show up at protests where people are peacefully protesting and decide, oh, I need to confront people or I need to shoot people, and have the belief that they can do this and walk away unscathed. It's really scary, and I'm very concerned about this mentality, this gun culture that is gripping this country in many states. And I'm very concerned about the safety of people who go out in the streets, as I do, to peacefully protest. We have a concern now in many of these states that have open carry about your own safety when you have the constitutional right under the First Amendment to peacefully protest and take to the streets.
Where do you see, I don't even want to call it a debate, but just we can't even get basic gun restrictions passed in this country. And we just had another horrific shooting in Michigan the other day. I mean, if you pay really close attention to shootings across this country, they happen multiple times a day. Where do you see this going?
I knew we were headed downhill in a bad place after the Sandy Hook shootings, because those were first graders, little kids who were mowed down, and we could not get Congress. And I say there are many good people in Congress who were saying we need to get these guns, we need gun control, and mostly primarily Democrats who were saying this, and we couldn't get it done because of the opposition, and mostly Republican opposition. And so I am not surprised, and I don't think any of us should be surprised as to where we are now. And I am extremely worried, extremely concerned. And I also say we must not give up. We must do whatever it takes, meaning we take to our courts, we elect people who will have the courage to face down the gun lobbies. And we have to do this on a local basis. And that means individuals who really care about these issues need to step up and run for local office. And I'm not just saying this. I mean, I have done that here where I live in the city of Palo Alto. I was very concerned about local politics. And so I decided to do something about it and step up and run for office and was elected to a city council. And one of the things I wanted to do was bring independent police oversight to the police department here. And we were able to do that. So I'm concerned. I'm not optimistic right now. But that being said, I'm also hopeful. I'm hopeful that there are a sufficient number of people in this country who will continue to protest and to push and to vote. That is really key to all of this stuff. Voting for judges, voting for legislation, voting for people who are in Congress to finally turn this stuff around.
Today we are speaking with Judge LaDoris Hazard Cordell. Her new memoir is called Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. Judge Cordell became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California. She served in that position from 1982 to 2001. Judge Cordell, let's talk about the Ahmaud Arbery case. And again, I hope over the holidays, over the next couple weeks, you can take the time to watch this 2020 documentary by Deborah Roberts, because she does such an amazing job of really connecting all of the dots. So just a reminder, because this case has taken so long, Ahmaud Arbery, a 25-year-old black man, was shot and killed on February 23rd, 2020. He was followed by 34-year-old Travis McMichael and his father Gregory. They were in one truck, and then William Roddy Bryan was in another truck. They eventually boxed him in and shot and killed him. You know, what's so just incredible about this case and so heartbreaking, Judge Cordell, is if it weren't for the video, which was, I want to get this right, it was 37 seconds. If it weren't for that video and then Ahmaud Arbery's mom, Wanda Cooper Jones, working tirelessly on this case, we probably wouldn't even know Ahmaud Arbery's name.
For that video, there would have been no prosecution, none whatsoever. And thank God for the video, and thank God for Ahmaud's mom, who knew that this killing was unjustified. And remember, Ahmad was unarmed.
Right. Unarmed. He was jogging.
He was running. That was it. But, I mean, so we look at the mentality of these individuals. You know what did not come out in the trial? The judge said this was not admissible, was that one of the three men made a statement when the first police officer arrived on the scene, and he used a racial slur. He used the N-word and said something to the effect, and I'm just paraphrasing, as we got us a N-word. And that did not come before the jury. But what we have here, so given all that, had there been no video, there would have been no prosecution, because it would have been their word saying, you know, they were attacked. Who knows? I mean, they came up with, by the way, this their self-defense argument. It was weak, and the jury did not buy it. The jury looked at that video, listened to the testimony, and, you know, the biggest thing in favor of the prosecution in that case was the testimony of the one defendant, one of the McMichaels. They made a decision, a strategic decision to put him on the stand. And that was a huge mistake for them and a big plus for the prosecution, because he just right up admitted, I wasn't threatened. He had no weapon. And yet we chased after him. And we know why they did it, because of their racist belief. Seeing a black person had no business being in that part of town and in their neighborhood.
Right. And what I learned in the documentary is that Ahmaud Arbery's family lives about 2 miles from Satilla Shores, where he was running. So that was about 2 miles from his home. And then Travis McMichael, his father Gregory, and William Roddy Bryan chased him for 5 minutes. So you can only imagine at that point, he sees these three men chasing him, how tired and wondering what the heck is going on here. I want to play one clip from the documentary and then ask you, Judge Cordell, about what this says about the system and what can be done about this. So again, this is a clip from a documentary about Ahmaud Arbery on 2020. And in this clip, you'll hear from Lee Merritt, a civil rights attorney who was working with Ahmaud Arbery's mom, Wanda Cooper Jones, journalist Christian Boone, and former FBI agent Brad Garrett.
In the Glynn County Police report, Wanda learns more about the details of that day.
Travis McMichael shot Ahmaud Arbery 3 times at close range with a shotgun.
6-7 around from here.
All right, guys, everybody's got the weapons up, correct?
Everybody's got the weapons up.
Okay.
While Ahmaud Arbery lay dying in the streets with Travis McMichael literally covered in Ahmaud Arbery's blood.
A black male, middle of the roadway, looks like about mid-20s.
Law enforcement began their investigation.
When police arrived on the scene inside Satilla Shores that day, Gray McMichael was almost animated in describing what had happened.
We see him come around the corner. He's going down here. We pull up beside him. Hey, stop. We want to talk to you. And he just keeps on running.
Travis McMichael, who had fired the fatal shots, was, you know, much more subdued. He was sitting on a curb.
Just breathe, okay?
Ahmaud's body was less than 10 feet away.
And then that's my father. He was with me with his whole thing.
Gray McMichael established the narrative, and he said Ahmaud attacked his son and Travis had acted in self-defense. And Gray McMichael tells the officers that, you know, I would have shot him myself if I had to.
Honest with you, if I could have got a shot at the guy, I'd have shot him myself.
When the police arrive, Gregory McMichael talks about his long history in law enforcement.
So I grabbed my 357 Magnum. It's an old Glynn County PD issue, by the way. When I was...
That he's just basically one of them.
You know, I was chief investigator with the DA's office for 23 years, so I know what you got to do. I know everything, you know.
Yep. Gray McMichael was formerly a police officer, and then he went to work for the district attorney's office.
As soon as he says that, they drop their guard and begin to give him professional courtesy. They don't look at him as someone who's perpetrated possibly a crime. They begin to look at him as a colleague. And they begin to take everything that he says at face value.
Yeah, it was just a damn melee. You know?
Yeah, yep.
They accepted everything he had to say as gospel.
What are they doing with my son over there? Are they?
I don't know, sir.
That is a clip from a 2020 documentary about Ahmaud Arbery. Judge Cordell, I mean, this is not unique, of course, to this case, but we actually see it in real time. When the father, Gregory McMichael, basically says he's one of them, everything changes at that moment.
You know, I'm sitting here shaking my head as I was listening to this, mm-hmm. and it's the classic double standard here. Two things. One, the assailants were white, and secondly, one of them was connected to law enforcement. So right away, everything changes. And all I say to people is when they say, oh, no, it's not a double standard. Sure, there is. Just flip it for a moment. Picture that these were three black men who had killed one white person. And how do you think law enforcement would have responded then? It would have been quite the opposite. They would have been probably, you know, down on the ground, handcuffed, maybe even beaten. So it is a sad statement, but thank God for video. Thank God for these body cameras, for dash cams that now are showing members of the public what really happens and what actually goes on. And you know, the other thing I want to bring up is that there's what's left now in this case is the sentencing. Mm-hmm. So all eyes should be on the trial judge now. This is going to be Judge Wampley who has to decide what is going to happen to these three people who have now been convicted of all of these serious crimes. Two of them guilty of felony murder, where they participate in a felony that results in a death. The two that did not actually pull the trigger. So all of them are going to be before the judge, and it is entirely in the judge's discretion as to what sentence to impose based upon whatever the rules and regulations are for sentencing.
And in February, they face federal hate crime charges.
Right. So there is more litigation to come. It'll be in a different form before a federal judge. And federal judges are appointed for life. State court judges are not. They serve specific terms. And so we're going to see a different part of the legal system. And federal courts do not allow cameras in. So this is going to be interesting to see if there will be a request to allow cameras in the courtroom, or if not that, at least audio. So I hope that we will have as much transparency as we had in the Arbery trial.
The other thing, Judge Cordell, that's amazing about this, and the video was actually 36 seconds. Law enforcement had this video since day one, and they did not act on it.
Right. And because they didn't think anything was wrong, they didn't believe a crime had been committed. And why? It's because of racism, because of their biases. And but for the video being revealed by the defendant, one of the defendants, there would have been no prosecution. And maybe, perhaps Ahmaud's mom would have been able to finally, with the help she had, get even those videos from the police disclosed. But it just was such an arduous process that she had to engage in. So when people say, yeah, we got justice in that case, I say, no, we didn't get justice. If we had justice, Ahmaud would be alive. Mm-hmm. What we got in this case was accountability. The system held these people accountable.
Also, just to go back to Ahmaud Arbery's mother, there were so many issues with the district attorneys. I mean, after the shooting occurs, Gregory McMichael called his former boss, District Attorney Jackie Johnson. We don't know if they had a phone call, but another district attorney was appointed. Wanda Cooper Jones did a basic online search and found even more conflicts of interest. And so then another district attorney was appointed. I mean, it's just incredible, Judge Cordell, to think about what people have to go through to get justice. This is basic information.
Absolutely. And people are getting a look at our legal system, which is why we need much more transparency. So in Ahmaud's case, we start with the DA, Jackie Lacey, right, who is now facing criminal charges for her failure to file charges. Then we had the Georgia Bureau of Investigations. That's the state agency. They then intervened. And that agency assigned the case to the DA in another county, in Cobbs County. And she's the one that stepped up, and she did a hell of a job in prosecuting that case. But that's what it took. to basically get accountability. And there would have been none had there not been the push, the mom saying this is not right and things have to change. And but for that, there we wouldn't be having this conversation today.
Well, Judge Cordell, we're getting a few emails from people who say, I have no comments, just thank you for your analysis. People are looking at the Rittenhouse case and the Arbery case kind of side by side. Are you looking at it that way?
I do. In fact, I even have a piece of paper in front of me now where I just put them side by side. And I looked at these different states, Wisconsin, which has a self-defense law that I think is absurd. I looked at Georgia, and I looked at all of the conflicts of interest in a DA's office in Georgia, and finally got exposed. And in these cases, they're very different in terms of the judges, how the judges presided over them. And all I can say to people is that we're at a time now where race is no longer the silent elephant in the courtroom, that we now talk about a race in terms of jury selection and everything else going in the courtroom. And it's about time, because racism is baked into our legal system and we need to recognize it, not be in denial, but also don't throw our hands up and think that there's nothing we can do about it. There's a lot that we can do to fix it, to make the system more just. So as I look at these two cases, they are lessons in accountability. They're lessons in what we need to do, the journey we need to still be on to make, to hold everyone who comes into our legal system and who participates in it, to hold them accountable.
Well, Judge Cordell, we really appreciate you talking about these two cases, and we would actually love to have you back to talk about your memoir, Her Honor, because there are so many stories we didn't have time for today, but we would love to have you back to discuss them.
I would love to come back, and thank you so much for the conversation. Thank you for the good that you do for bringing this information to the public.
Well, thank you so much. It's been great to talk with you. We've been speaking with Judge LaDoris Hazard Cordell. Her book, Her Honor, My Life on the Bench, What Works, What's Broken, and How to Change It. We will definitely have Judge Cordell back to talk more about her book. She became the first African-American woman to sit on the Superior Court of Northern California from 1982 to 2001. We did not have time to talk about the future of Roe in this country. We will definitely discuss the future of abortion rights tomorrow on Your Call. We will also discuss the latest in Sudan. On October 25th, Sudan's military seized power in a coup. Since then, 42 people have been killed in mass anti-military protests. And I'm going to be taking a couple weeks off. You'll be in good hands with a few rebroadcasts, and Ethan Elkind will be hosting, and then we'll be back during the Christmas holiday. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.